So the Buddha is obviously going to give an answer. And that's the first part of your reading there. He says that Bodhisattvas, the first thing he says is that Bodhisattvas should work for sentient. Okay, what's a sentient?
Mind haver.
Okay, anything that has a mind. Anyone that has a mind. In Buddhist philosophy, it only refers to... By the way, do Buddhas have a mind?
Yes.
Of course. Because your mind never stops. That's the whole point. That's why your former births are beginningless. And that's why your future lives are endless, timeless. So sentient, a Buddha has a mind. Is a Buddha a sentient? Not in Buddhist philosophy. Okay. Sentient only refers to mind-havers who are still suffering in samsara. Alright? So the word sentient, which literally means living being, sentient being, anything that has a mind, it's not correct. Technically, it's not correct, because it only refers to non-Buddha beings who have minds. Okay? So that's the first trick. So when the Buddha says that Bodhisattvas should work for sentience, he means all living beings who are still suffering. And to make sure he covers all living beings, he divides them up into different ways, okay? And I'll give you the first one. You say, Kene? Kenishi. Okay. I know you don't want to learn Tibetan, but it just puts a little C in your mind, okay? You don't have to know the Tibetan. I'll write the English up here, but it's good for you. Okay, ke means what? Do you know anything? Kewa? Kewa means to be born. Kene means a place to be born. She means four. So literally it means the four places to be born. What it really means is the four ways of being born. The four ways you can take birth. Okay. There's four ways that essentially being... Say gonke?
Gonke.
Okay, the first way to take birth is gonke. Gong means gonga, means egg. Ke means born. Okay? So gonke means egg born. It means anyone born from an egg. Any sentient being born from an egg. Chickens. Alright. That's the first way you can take birth. Second one is nyauke. Say nyauke. Nyauke.
Nyauke.
Okay. Nyau means miawa. This is the way most human beings are born. So what do you guess? Born from?
Womb.
Okay? Nyau means the womb. That's the second way you can take birth. If you're not a chicken. third one is.
Is that one word, share life? Or is there a separation between
the two? Yeah, it's two different words, share and yeah. You don't have to know this, but it's nice to know, you know, it's nice to have it. Say, tushin, lekewa. Tushin, lekewa.
Tushin, lekewa.
Okay. Dren means warmth. Share means moisture. Lekewa means born from. Okay. Born from warmth and moisture. This refers to an idea that they had in ancient India that when the first summer day comes and suddenly there's flies all over the place, that they must have been born through the warmth and the moisture. There's a word in medieval.
Spontaneous generation.
Yeah, spontaneous generation. We also used to think that, right? Is there any real spontaneous generation?
No.
Okay, well.
What about like fungus?
Maybe.
It doesn't qualify as sentient being, though.
If it's a virus or something. I don't know, maybe something. Anyway, the last one is, say, zutekyawa.
Zutekyawa.
Zutekyawa. Zutekyawa means, zute means miraculously. Kyawa means born. Okay. What it means is born finished, sometimes even with your clothes on. All right, you just appear. You're already a doll. And that's the way that people are born, for example, in hell. You don't have a hell mommy and a hell daddy who bring you up. You just appear in hell, already adult, and you start suffering the second you appear in hell. I can't prove that one to you. It's in the scriptures, you know. If there is a hell, then how do people get born there? Well, they appear there. They die here. They go through Bardo. And then they just appear in hell. They already have they don't go through a growing up process in hell. They just appear there as fully grown beings and they start suffering.
A Buddha could ask the same thing too, not in hell, but no?
These are four ways to take birth in samsara.
Okay.
Buddha could take any one of them if he wanted to. He could pretend to take any one of them. And he has. So those are the four ways to take birth. So The Buddha is talking to Subhuti. He's answering Subhuti's question. By the way, you see these in the Abhidharma, third chapter, towards the middle of the third chapter. They're very famous. But the reason that the Buddha is... Why would the Buddha tell Subhuti, save all sentient beings who are born in one of these four ways? It covers all six realms of beings. It covers all kinds of beings there are. So the Buddha doesn't have to say all living beings. If he says, save anybody who's born in one of these four ways, how many living beings has he covered?
Four beings in the karmic realm.
Sitakyala? They're born finished. They just show up there. We'll talk about it. We're getting there. Anyway, they all show up. This is the four. So it covers everybody. Okay? So it's a way to say everybody. It's also a way to say there's more beings around than you think there are. There's more kinds of birth than you know about. You know, it's an interesting way for the Buddha to remind us that there's sentient beings that we're not even aware of, that we can't see. We don't have any contact with them. They're stated in the scripture. Sentient beings, you can go to hell and see hell. You have to have a companion who has the power to take you there. So it's interesting that Dante went to hell with a companion, you know. The companion took Dante to hell. And Dante's description of hell is very, very similar to the Buddha's description of hell. So those are the four kinds of birth. Then the Buddha goes on. Now he's going to do a different division of all sentient beings. Okay? He says, Sukchen. Say Sukchen.
Sukchen.
Do you know what Suk means? Heart Sutra, Sukh Sava Dushi Dichin Membership in Tomo. It's the first of the five skandhas. Your form. Form meaning your physical body. Okay? Your physical body. Sukh means your physical body. Sukchen means someone who has a physical body. Say Sukchen Min.
Sukchen Min.
Sukchen Min.
Sukchen Min.
What's that?
Min.
Yeah, when you learn Tibetan, which you will eventually, Ma, Mi, Min, Me are the four negatives. They're all with an M sound. Ma, Mi, Min, Me. So, Sukchen Min means what? Yeah, those who don't have physical form. What the Buddha is doing, he's referring to the three realms. What are the three realms?
Desire, form, and form.
Okay, desire realm, form realm, and formless realm. We're in the desire realm. Okay, we're in the realm where people live by their senses. We mostly live by physical attraction to food or sex or objects like that. And that's why our realm is called the desire realm. There's a realm above us called the form realm. The form realm is very similar to what I think a Christian would think about heaven. It's very similar to what the descriptions of heaven sound like. You know, you're born there, Dzutekyowa. You're born there in the lap of your parents, already pretty mature, and you have this beautiful form, you live in this beautiful place, everything is happy, people spend their whole day holding hands in the park and enjoying themselves, and everything is golden, and, you know, very pleasant. And it goes on for a long, long time. You reach that by spending a lot of time in this life meditating, but not meditating on anything particularly important, like just calming your mind down, just keeping your mind on your thoughts, watching your thoughts, trying to think about nothing, just trying to be calm. If you do that very, very well in this life, it's a cause to be born there. Because you're in meditation, even though it's not a useful meditation, you don't commit any bad deeds. You can't commit any of the physical or verbal bad deeds. Because you can't get up and you can't talk while you're in deep meditation. So automatically you avoid a lot of the bad deeds that other people do. So you take birth in a kind of a heaven. It's a nice heaven. You stay there for a long time. But then when that karma exhausts itself, when the karma of having been just calm in this life and peaceful in this life exhausts itself, normally the only karma left in your karmic pocket is bad karma. So there's a flow chart of beings down from the form realm down to the hell. It's considered by most true Buddhists to be a real lousy birth, because all you do is you burn up bad karma very quickly because it's so pleasant, and then you're born into hell normally. So those two realms, you have bodies.
Burn up good karma very quickly?
Bad karma.
Okay. You don't bring up any bad karma because everything's nice. What do you think this refers to? Formless realm. Okay, formless realm is supposed to be a realm where people are born and they don't have bodies. They're only made of mind. All they have is a mind. Where is that realm located? In which direction?
Up.
There's nothing physical there. There is no direction. Wherever that being dies, and he just immediately enters the formless realm. The formless realm is wherever he died.
Okay. And then what happens to him?
It's the same thing. It's a flowchart down. It's very pleasant.
No, I mean in that realm. What?
Nothing much. They can't communicate much with each other. And, you know, it's pretty much just a very subtle, mindless sort of long, pleasant, like you're in a kind of meditation. Any kind of thought you have, they don't sleep. You know, when they start to sleep, they go into deep meditation. And it's just a long, pleasant life, mental life.
How do you get there?
Again, from meditations on an even deeper meditation called formless realm meditation. So there's two formless realms and there's two form realms. One is called the causal and one is called the resultant. We won't go into it. Causal means if you put your mind in that realm often enough, you'll be born there after you die. And this is referring to the result. This is referring to a birth. So this is formless realm. It's very dangerous to learn that meditation. You know, it's easy to mistake it for something. It is nice in the sense that you become a better, calmer person. You know, in this life, you're more satisfied, you're happier, you're not committing bad deeds. So since in your early part of your life, you're not committing bad deeds, the later part of your life is rather pleasant. So you can really mistake it for spiritual progress. You know, you can really easily mistake it for some kind of real spiritual progress. And it's pleasant.
Object-less meditation? Or the object is not a holy object?
A non-Buddhist can achieve it. A non-Buddhist can put his mind... Non-Buddhists have put their minds on cow's horns and things like that.
Right.
And achieved the deep feeling that they had horns. And during that time, because they were concentrating, they didn't commit any bad deeds. You can't say anything bad if you're in deep meditation. You can't kill, steal, or do sexual misconduct while you're in deep meditation. So they and you really can't hate. You can't crave deeply and be in deep meditation. So they do have some nice, pleasant.
But you're really talking about the object. I mean, if you were in the same kind of meditation and your object. Oh,
absolutely. If you're meditating on if you were analyzing emptiness. If you were meditating on your understanding of emptiness, or if you were meditating on compassion, or if you were meditating on purification, or confession, or things like that, it would be tremendously powerful. In fact, you cannot see emptiness unless your mind goes into the form realm. If you can't put your mind into the form realm, you can't see emptiness directly. Impossible. If you can't reach that deep meditation, it's called Samden Dhamma Nyerdo Micho Me. It's a specific level within the first level of the form realm. If you can't get into that deep meditation, you'll never see emptiness directly. If you're not meditating daily, you cannot ever see emptiness directly. You never will. If you're not practicing at least a half hour or 45 minutes of really deep meditation daily, you've already ruled yourself out. You can't see it. Never will. Okay, Sukhchen and Sukhchen Mahimba. So the Buddha tells Subhuti, save all sentient beings who are either Sukhchen or Sukhchen Mahimba. How many does that cover? Everybody. Okay. There's no other realm. By the way, the Buddha is outside of these three realms. These are the three realms of suffering. Buddha's not in these three realms. So if the Buddha tells the Buddha, look, bodhisattvas are supposed to worry about people in the three realms, there's two things he's saying. One is he's saying all sentient beings. The other thing he's saying is that, look, Subhuti, there's beings that you don't even know about. You know, there's realms that you've never dreamed of. You've never seen them. He's trying to impress on Subhuti how many sentient beings there are. It's a big responsibility. You can't even see them. You're not even sure they exist. If you're an honest Buddhist and you haven't perceived these realms, in fact, it's not maybe till the path of seeing that you can honestly say that you've seen them and you know they exist. Then he does one more. Say, Dushichen.
Dushichen.
Dushichen. Dushichen. Okay. Dushi is an interesting word. It has two meanings. Okay? It has two meanings. It's the third of the five skandhas. It's the third of the five parts to a human being. And in that case, It means the ability to discriminate. The ability to make distinctions. This is good, this is bad. This is my friend, this is my enemy. This is red, this is blue. You see a lot of weird translations of the five skandhas. They're very, very poor translations. They're unintelligible. And they don't have to be. It's very clearly stated in the Abhidharma Kosha first chapter. Samarjana Dushya. Dushya is the ability to discriminate. The other kind of Dushya means to be able to conceive of something. Okay? To have a conception of something. And it means like this. The classic example is, let's say, for a monk. Okay? A monk, when he looks at a woman, is supposed to think of her either as his sister, if she's the same age, or as his mother, if she's older, or as his daughter, if she's younger. So when you look at a lady, you're not supposed to think of her as available. You're supposed to... when a monk is supposed to train himself, so when he looks at a lady, either he sees it's someone that he feels, he has the emotion of his sister, or his mother, or his daughter. And that's called Dushya. To think of them as that. To conceive of them as that. That's the meaning, conception. The other example of Dushya, very famous, is that, and it was stated by Vajrapani, that you should see your lama, conceive of your lama as being the Buddha. And then he has a whole list of reasons why. But that's Dushya, that's conception. So Dushya Chen, what do you think it means? This is the Chen in Simchen. It means what? Yeah, has, possesses. Anyone who has Dushya, all right? Anyone who has the ability to discriminate or the ability to conceive of anything. And that's us. We have that ability. We make discriminations all the time. Like, this is my friend. This is my enemy. I like this. I don't like this. By the way, it is not the point of Buddhism to remove this mental function. A lot of people make that mistake. Okay? It's not that you, when you reach a higher level in Buddhism, that you don't say anymore, this is good, this is bad, this is left, this is right, this is blue, this is red. You know, I've heard a lot of people say, you know, I'm getting pretty good because I go to work and I don't think of him this way and think of him this way. It's not the point. It's not the point. It's not that you reach some level where you can't discriminate between evil and good, or that you can't discriminate between left and right. It's not the point. It's different than that. Here's the point. That you change the evil by collecting good karma with knowledge. How's that?
I like it.
Michael, does that refer to your own evil, or does it refer to evil outside of you?
Both. Because you will become a Buddha and your world will become a paradise. Inner and outer worlds. And they have different causes that you have to collect for each of those. In fact, they're diamond cutters. Say, Dushya Mepa?
Dushya Mepa.
Okay. Dushya Mepa is also described in the second chapter of the Abhidharma Kosha. And it means, what does it mean?
Someone who can't.
Yeah, someone who can't make any discriminations at all. Now, discrimination, the ability to discriminate, it's part of every mind in the universe. Okay? The Buddha has it. Hell beings have it. Dogs have it. Germs have it. Okay? Dushya. I mean, the amoebas flutter away from some things and flutter towards other things. You know, they have this discrimination. You can't have a mind and not have discrimination. There are five mental functions that all minds have, and we have this one. Every being has it. So, is there any such thing as a Dushya Mepa? Well, obviously, but I mean living beings.
Can that refer to a temporary state?
It does. Okay, it refers to a state where your dushya is so tuned down that you're called a you're called a person who's not making any distinctions. You're called a person who's making no discriminations at all. It's just a name. It's a label. There is no such being. But we had it in the other course. Your mind is almost shut down. Sometimes they call it a mindless state, and then the next sentence they say, by the way, it's not mindless, it just means your mind is very, very, it's almost into a state of suspended animation. There's a big debate in the monastery how this can happen. You debate it a lot. What's the state of mind with which you go into it, and what's the state of mind that brings you out of it?
This is the same thing as subtle level consciousness.
It is. You have extremely subtle levels. So this refers to having gross, the ability to make gross discriminations. This refers to beings who are in a very, very subtle meditation where they almost don't make any discriminations. Their mind is almost turned off. But the Buddha goes further. He says, not that and not that. Not people who make rough discriminations, and not people who only have very, 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 very fine discriminations. Who's that? Is that possible?
Yeah, all the others.
Okay, yeah, all right. What it means is, you're not making the roughest discrimination, but you're also not in the state where you've got nothing but very, 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 very fine ones. You're in a state where you have sort of fine ones. You're in between these two. You don't have any rough, you're not as bad as desire around people, but you're not to the very last level of samsara where your mind is nearly shut down. You're sort of halfway up to that. And it's described, it's called, there's different levels.
So these are two categories that you're supposed to benefit? Two categories of beings you're supposed to benefit as a bodhisattva?
Three. Okay? What are the three? I'll repeat them, okay? You have to help people have very, very gross, rough minds. That's us in the desire realm. You know, we live off cookies, good, bad, we hate people or we love people. You know, our discriminations are very, very gross. Not subtle at all. Then there's beings at the very highest level of samsara. It's very similar to nirvana in the sense that their minds are very, very subtle. They're almost making no gross discriminations. I mean, no even subtle discriminations. And then there's beings they are not as rough as us, and they're not as fine as them. And that's all the Buddha means. And if you didn't have the commentary, the Tibetan commentary, which was just discovered, you would never know that. It's great. You people are really fortunate. I mean, we're very fortunate to have the first really good explanation. Yeah.
And that was called Duche.
Duche me, Duche me min. And it's in the reading. It's on the first page, okay? Duche me, Duche me min. Duche me min, Duche me min. Duche me min, Duche me min.
Say it four times fast.
Yeah.
I still don't get the not part, though. I mean,
they're not people with rough discrimination.
Who we're supposed to be trying to help.
It's the third category.
Right.
You're supposed to help people with rough discriminations like us.
So,
A, you're supposed to help the people who are at the highest level of suffering life, who make very, very subtle discriminations. And you're supposed to help the people who are sort of in between, who are not as bad as us and not as good as them. They're not us and they're not them.
So, I guess the first Dushichen is referring to
desire realm people like us.
Sukchen and Duche Mepas are referring to Sukchen Min?
Yeah,
is that where you get
that.
The not from?
You,
those two categories plus those two, those who are not in those two categories.
Yeah, actually this refers, if you want to get like that, if you want to ask that question, you don't have to write this down. It refers to the fourth level of the form of stuff. It's called Sitte. It's called the peak. It's the peak mental state of still being a suffering being. Okay, it can easily be mistaken for nirvana.
That's Duche Mepa.
Yeah. And you can see that in your reading. And then there's a level called Debuche. That's another level, and that's where most of the beings who are in between and stuff. But you don't have to worry about it, alright? What's the point here?
Alpha, Omega, and all points in between.
Yeah, that's all. He's trying to say, listen, all sentient beings, you've never even seen the last two I'm talking about. You have no experience of them. You've got to take them on trust from me for the time being. You're going to have to save them too. You're out to help them too. Yeah.
Are you talking about category of being here?
Sure.
The fourth level of the formless realm? Or are you just talking about any being
that
achieved this state, albeit temporarily?
Yeah.
And what's the example?
We've all been there, by the way, countless times.
No, but I'm saying...
Whoever's there right now.
Someone close to... Somebody who's very spiritually advanced.
Yeah.
Somebody who's an Arya. Presumably... fits into this realm, at least when they're in deep meditation?
No, it's very interesting.
Are you born into this realm?
You're born into that realm because you did deep meditation.
Okay.
You wouldn't want to be in that realm. Normally, Aryas are not produced in that realm. The desire realm is perfect for producing Aryas.
But they still can have this very subtle level of mind.
They only have that very subtle level. But in its resultant form.
Okay.
But for us, the desire realm is the only place to really make progress because we have a lot of suffering. They say those other two realms are lousy for making spiritual progress. They're too happy. you know, and it goes for people who have a good life in this life. You know, if you're fairly well off and you're comfortable and you don't have any personal disasters in your life, you know, it's very hard to be spiritual. They say a good dose of suffering is very good for pushing you into Dharma practice. Normally, people I've known in Dharma centers who are doing very well, a lot of them have had some great personal tragedy. It seems to push them into Dharma. So they say this realm is really the best. You're lucky to be born in this realm. If you have too much suffering, like hell realm, hell beings cannot frame a clear thought. In the whole millions of years that they spend there, they can't have a single clear, conscious thought. All they can think about is pain. The only conception they have is terrible pain. And then the beings who are in the formless realm or the form realm, they're just like people in this park and women and men playing with each other and dancing and enjoying and golden lights and happy and nothing ever goes wrong. They don't have poop. I mean, nothing, you know. It's just perfect. And then suddenly one day they die. Just before they die, they have terrible things happen to them.
You just said nothing happens bad, and now you're
saying. Not till the last few days. In the last few days, they get some kind of temporary clairvoyance where they know what's going to happen. They know where they're going, and then they say the suffering in those last few days is more terrible than all those years of pleasure.
So suffering is included because they are not dying altogether. Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
Always somebody is dying.
Well, then when someone starts to get. The last few days, they say your garlands start to wilt, wrinkles start to show, your hair starts to fall out, and the other people avoid you, like the plague. They don't want to look at you. You're a bad part of the bliss, you know? You're like an oddball, and people consciously start, your body starts to have perspiration for the first time, you start to smell, and they don't want to ruin their day by looking at you. So part of the suffering is that they don't even pay attention to you. It's like you're an outcast. And they don't even want to talk to you anymore. Your old friends just walk away from you. No one wants to approach you. It's a very weird karma at the end of their lives. Okay. So the Buddha covers them. And then he says you should take people to Nyangin Nagepa, all right? If you're a bodhisattva. So who are you focusing on? All sentient beings. The long definition of bodhisattva is Tenkin Kamjiba Mikshi. Starts out like that. You focus on all sentient beings. Then you want them to achieve Nyangin Ledepa. Say Nya.
Nya.
Ledepa. Nyangin Ledepa is the Tibetan word for what? No. Nirvana. Okay.
Is this in further division or no?
Something no. Else? We got all the sentient beings. We know who they are now. What do you want to do to them? What do you want to lead them to? He says Nyangin Ledepa. He says Nirvana. Why did the Tibetans translate Nirvana as Nyangin Ledepa? Okay, Nirvana means to blow out. Van is related to ventilation. It's the words in English for wind. But why did the Tibetans call it Nyangin Ledepa? Nyangin means grief or sorrow. It's exactly the word for grief. You know, the dog at our house wouldn't eat for a couple of days after she went to the hospital, after her llama went to the hospital. She refused to eat for about 4 days. And that's called Nyangin. That's called grieving. And Chöne Dapa Shedup, the Tibetan commentary writer, he gives a very nice definition of grief. He says grief includes about three different things. The first one is mental afflictions. What does that mean, mental? It's defined as anything that disturbs your mind, okay? I mean, the Sanskrit word is klesha. It comes from a root klish. And klish means to bother somebody. In fact, the definition of a mental affliction is a thought that bothers your, disturbs your peace of mind. And what are the big six, you know? There's six main ones, 22 minor ones. Anger.
Attachment.
Attachment. Ignorance. Jealousy. Pride. And the ignorance. So these are the things that cause all your trauma. If you have those six, and they're all their little brothers, okay, what will you do?
Create negative karma.
You create karma, okay. If you didn't have those six, you wouldn't do bad karma. If you didn't do bad karma, then starting today, you wouldn't have any new problems. Okay, you wouldn't be creating any new
problems. You'd still be suffering.
You would. Oh, that's called
hot
chick.
The karma for
you. You still have this suffering body. You still have this lousy result of your past bad deeds. But you wouldn't have any new ones. You wouldn't be creating any new problems for yourself. So if you could get rid of number one, you wouldn't have any problems in the future. If you could really destroy those six bad thoughts, you wouldn't have any problems in the future. New problems. Okay. In fact, destroying the enemy of the bad thoughts in Sanskrit is called what? What? Arhat. Arhat comes from a verbal root meaning kill. So when they say arhat or enemy destroyer, that's exactly what they're referring to. You got rid of those six bad thoughts.
Yeah. Yeah, see if I understand this correctly. You're saying mental afflictions cause the mind to be disturbed.
Ruin your peace of mind. That's a definition. By the way, you know you have them when you're not happy. You know they're functioning when you're not when you're unhappy.
But
your
you
peace
can
of mind.
Happy in a deluded way.
You can be. I mean, you can be drunk and wild. You can be wild. That's true. But definitely when you're unhappy, the Abhidharma says there's only one kind of unhappiness, which is not a klesha, and that's regret about something bad you did. If you feel bad about having done something bad, that's a virtue. But most other kinds of feeling bad are just mental affliction, and they're causing you karma. Karma itself. The karma that you are enjoying or suffering from now, when was it created?
Many lifetimes ago.
Or?
For the vast majority of it, or some last life, or some in this life.
Some even in this life. Okay, so karma is everything you did up to now that's created your present condition. It's the boomerang the boomerangs that you threw in the past, and that are hitting you in the head now. That's karma, because of the mental afflictions you had in the past. Because you hated, or because you desired, you did something, you created karma. So it's a twofold process. It's very, very interesting. It's very, very within your grasp to do it. You can do it. If you practice well, if you educate yourself as a Buddhist in all the methods, if you remove your mental afflictions, which is mainly done by perceiving emptiness. In fact, that's the definition of it. Nyingde Manupa Pame Soso Tango means it's done by perceiving emptiness directly. And then if you removed your karma, if you had some magic thing that could remove all the bad karma that you ever did before, a lot of things would change right away for you. If you could start to whittle down that karma, if you could start to rub on that karma or work on that karma, and if you found a way to lessen that karma, you would actually find physical signs in your body now. You know, your body would start to change. Whatever illnesses you had, or signs of age you had, or things like that, it would actually start to lessen. If you did it really, really well, your body would change completely. So that's very important. That's the idea of purification. We'll talk about it. Okay. If it's not happening, you're not doing purification right. So mental afflictions and karma. Then he wraps it up by saying, suffering, dunya, right? Suffering. So if somebody on a homework asked you, I love this. What are the three kinds of grief? You would say mental afflictions, which are going to cause you problems in the future. Karma, which is what is causing you all your problems now. And suffering, which is kind of the two of them put together.
I thought these were components of grief. These are kinds of grief?
These are what grief refers to in the word jnana nidheva. What does nidheva mean? They mean from.
I don't understand the statement. Can you explain the statement?
The Tibetan word for nirvana is literally means gone beyond sorrow, to go beyond sorrow, to transcend sorrow or grief. Jnana nidheva, the Tibetan word for nirvana, is to get yourself out of grief. And grief means the bad thoughts that you have that are going to cause you trouble starting 5 minutes from now. And the karma you collected in the past, which is what's causing all the pain that you have now. Okay? And if you could go beyond those two, if you could get away from those two. And in fact, he gives you a different word in the commentary for depa. He gives you a new verb. He says, le depa to go beyond, oh, hey, you could just use the word tarpa. What's tarpa mean? Freedom. I mean, somebody in England has called their book publishing tarpa. Their center is tarpa. Tarpa means moksha. Moksha means freedom. So freedom from your own bad thoughts and freedom from the bad karma you've collected in the past, which has you in its clutches, would be nirvana. And that's the definition of nirvana. Nirvana is defined as nirvana sosa tango, which means eliminating your bad thoughts and your mental afflictions because you saw emptiness directly.
I'm confused. Greed to comprise of
greed.
Sorrow?
Yeah.
Of greed.
These are all, not
well,
three different
leads,
kinds,
one
but all these
the
together
other.
Are what grief is.
Okay.
You could say that. Grief is a big bundle of these three.
Okay.
Alright. I've got this too, and then I'm suffering is...
Suffering is just that they're not separate, just, you know, they're not distinct from each other. Suffering is the result of these two, actually.
So when you said that the dog was feeling...
I wanted to prove to you, see, in colloquial Tibetan, in modern Tibetan, nyangen literally means grief. You can see a lot of strange translations from people don't know Tibetan very well. But nyangen literally means, really does mean grief. In the sense that grief means to you, when someone dies and you go to the funeral and you're feeling grief, that's exactly what the word means. That's the feeling of the word in Tibetan. That's exactly the connotation of the word.
But are you suggesting that the dog has too much attachment?
Not at all. Not
oh,
at
no,
all.
Okay.
I'm just trying to say that that word literally does mean the kind of grief you have when someone dies or something.
The intensity.
Yeah. However,
the trouble, you know, the sorrow that you have. So all these things, to continue to think those six bad thoughts, to continue to be at the mercy of this karma, which is going to force you to get ugly and old, it's grief, it's sorrow, something lousy. Yeah.
So when an arhat goes to a funeral, they don't feel grief.
I don't know.
No, really. I mean, is that what it means? To go beyond your grief?
No.
I mean, when you're beyond.
They get the metaphor. You could have called it poop, okay?
So there's no such thing as being grief.
That's what it Wait, sorry.
I got
matches. You don't have to write that, but I just want you to see it, okay? This is the definition of bodhicitta. This is what bodhicitta is. If you ever need to know, if anyone ever asks you, but you know, it's one of the three most important ideas in Buddhism. You should really know the definition. You should really know what it is. Okay? And please repeat, okay? It's Semkhye Pani. Semkhye Pani means bodhicitta is, okay. Bodhicitta is, however it's called bodhi mind, some people translate as bodhi mind, it has nothing to do with the mind of the Buddha, okay. Completely different things. Don't get confused. Semkhye Pani, bodhicitta, is defined as shenzhen shir means for the sake of others, for the sake of other living beings, for the sake of other living beings. Yan ba do pe chang chu means total enlightenment, total enlightenment. Okay, yan ba do pe chang chu means total enlightenment. They say total because, not because there's enlightenments that aren't total, but there are lower nirvanas that are called enlightenment that aren't total enlightenment. That's why they say total. It used to confuse me. I mean, you're either enlightened or you're not. I can't see getting half enlightened or something. Okay. Total enlightenment. Dhe means to wish. To wish for. So the definition of bodhicitta, very, very, very important, is the wish to achieve total enlightenment for the sake of all other beings. To wish to become a totally enlightened being in order to help all other beings. This definition is from the Abhisamaya Alankara. It's a perfection of wisdom. Who wrote it? Do you know? Do you remember? I'll tell you who wrote it down. The Sangha wrote it down.
Manjushri.
Close.
Maitreya.
Maitreya. My chair dictated this. Who's my chair? Buddha of the future according to the... According to sutra. According to Nanta. According to Tantra, he's already a Buddha. I guess.
According to Tantra, he's what?
I can't tell you anyway. Forget it. Anyway, it was written by the future Buddha. Okay, it was written by the future Buddha. 10th level Bodhisattva, if you will. Right, highest level Bodhisattva. This is his definition of Bodhisattva, so it's pretty cool. What was Bodhisattva supposed to do? And the Buddha answer is what?
Bring all sentient beings
to Nirvana. By the way, there's one point about that nirvana. In the book, in the Diamond Cutter Sutra, there's this little adjective before the nirvana, yong-su. Yong-su. That means total nirvana, and that means Buddha. There's a big difference between nirvana and Buddha, and we won't go into it tonight. But basically, the Buddha says, the work of a bodhisattva, the job for bodhisattvas, what bodhisattvas got to spend their time on, is getting all sentient beings to enlightenment. Does that fit Mr. Maitreya's description of bodhicitta? Is there anything missing?
It says bringing yourself versus bringing others.
Nice. Very nice. Okay. She pointed out that in the definition given by Maitreya, he says, wishing yourself to achieve Buddhahood in order to help other sentient beings. The Buddha didn't mention that at all in the Diamond Cutter Sutra. He just said, bodhisattvas are supposed to try to get other beings to enlighten.
It's kind of like college, it's a prerequisite.
It is, and that's exactly what you should think. Exactly what you should think. You should think, well, Michael, why, what's the big deal? Because you couldn't enlighten other people anyway if you didn't achieve it yourself first. You have to reach enlightenment yourself first to be of any great help to other people.
But then they talk about the great bodhisattvas who postpone their enlightenment.
No such thing. Metaphor.
Okay, this is all.
Yeah, who would want to? What use? That's
and
like
they
saying.
Still call them
that's like saying, I won't finish medical school so I can cure everybody. You know?
Why the hyperbole?
It's a long story. It refers to the nobleness of their intentions, but not to what they actually do. They would be willing to stand last in line. If there is a line to go to Buddhahood, they would be willing to be last. So noble is their intention. But of course, they go in first so they can help other people.
Well, then why do we define those three different ways?
The third one was metaphor. Yes.
You had, the definition you gave us of what to do with all the sentient beings. Yeah, it says the nanya na ledepa. So which definition should we use? To take them to nirvana or take them to...
Full nirvana.
Full nirvana.
You should add the word full nirvana. Right. The Buddha himself adds the word full nirvana. But what Tony Dabashidib says, don't forget, in his commentary he says, okay, the Buddha didn't mention that you had to achieve enlightenment yourself to get to do all this. But of course, that's your goal. The Tibetan Lam Rim texts say, eat the meat yourself. You remember that story? Yeah. It means that a guy and his family are starving. He finds a little piece of meat, and selfishly he eats the whole thing. Why?
So that he can go out and get food for
So he has the strength to go out and get other food for his family. If he had split it up with everybody, they all would have died together. So actually it was the most noble thing he could do. It means achieve Buddhahood first, then you really be capable to help him. So that's my trade-off definition. We'll take a break, and we'll start in about... If you come back in about 10 minutes, we can finish on time. 10, 15 minutes. But don't be shy. Please come over and... he says, by the way, Sabuti, if you could do what I asked you to do, which was what?
Take everyone to Nirvana. Take everyone to Nirvana.
Yeah, total Nirvana, meaning Buddhahood. If you could take all the beings in all the realms, in every condition, body or no body, mind or no mind, for, you know, whatever can born from an egg, the womb, anyway, if you could take all of them to total nirvana, even if you could, nobody would reach total nirvana.
Oh.
Okay? That's what the Buddha says. Nobody would be there. No, nobody would reach total nirvana. if you could take them, the beings that got there wouldn't even exist. No one would reach Nirvana. The person that reached Nirvana was nobody. And what the Buddha is indicating is two kinds of samkhya. What's samkhya?
A mind habit.
Bodhicitta. That's samkhya. Okay? He's indicating two kinds of samkhya. Why the scripture is so popular. Why it's been misinterpreted so much. Say, Kunzo Senke.
Kunzo Senke.
Kunzo Senke.
Kunzo Senke.
And say, Dundam Senke.
Dundam Senke.
Dundam Senke.
Dundam Senke.
Okay. Senke in each case means bodhicitta. Okay? The wish you could become a Buddha to help all living beings. That word is the same in each case. These are two kinds of bodhicitta, which is defined as the wish to achieve Nirvana, Buddhahood, for the sake of total Buddhahood, for the sake of all living beings. Kunzo means false. Dundam means ultimate. So there's what we call false, or sometimes we call it deceptive. Why is it deceptive? It refers to the two truths, or the two realities. Okay, there's two realities. There are two realities. One reality is the reality you're experiencing right now, if you are who you seem to be. Okay, I don't know that for sure. But you, right now, can only see deceptive reality. What they call deceptive truth, or you could call it false truth for that matter. You can only see a reality which is deceptive. What does deception mean in normal English?
Nothing.
Yeah, not what it appears to be. Hey man, this car is great. You know, he's got 20,000 miles. The guy is an invalid. He never drove it. You know, I'm selling it to you because I like you. You know, and it's $50. You know, it's a Lexus. And the appearance is quite a great deal. And then when you get in the car, it explodes. You know, something happens. Doesn't have any tires.
There's no motor.
Yeah. That's deception. So deception, the whole idea of deception depends on looking to be great and actually being something else. Or looking to be one way, appearing to be one way, and being not that in reality. Okay. That's called deceptive reality. When you first see emptiness directly, when the day comes that you achieve the path of seeing, when you have that 5-10 minute experience in deep meditation, as you come down, after you come out, you realize that you never in your whole life up to that point had a thought that was accurate. Every single perception you ever had since you were a child up to that point was false. You were not seeing things correctly. Things were not the way they seemed. When you come out of that experience, that tendency reasserts itself. Except you know you're crazy. Okay? The only difference, you realize that you're doing the same thing again, and you are still misperceiving everything. But at least you know you're doing it. And the process of cleaning out that is the only difference between you and reaching Nirvana. When you finally clean that out, you've reached Nirvana. That is Nirvana. So that's what deceptive reality means. It's a reality that looks one way, but is actually a different way. And we'll talk more about that. So, would a bodhisattva see that kind of reality? Would a bodhisattva always be fooled? Would a bodhisattva always be seeing things wrong? What do you think?
As long as he's out of emptiness meditation.
Yeah, right. As long as he's not in the direct perception of emptiness, and if he is not a Buddha, yes, it's true. He's seeing everything wrong.
But does he know?
If he has reached the path of seeing, he knows it. But you can achieve bodhicitta long before the path of seeing. It's one thing to learn to love all living beings. It's quite a different thing to perceive ultimate reality. You can learn this first. You always do. Sometimes they're almost simultaneous. So when I say that bodhicitta is focusing on all living beings and wishing that they could become enlightened, what kind of reality is all those sentient beings?
assume that they concretely exist.
It's deceptive reality. Okay? Unless you are at a very high state, which happens to be the first place of Buddha, you, when you look at all those sentient beings and you're wishing that they can achieve nirvana, you are seeing them wrong. You're seeing the wrong thing. You are mistaken. What you think you see and what's really there are totally different. That's why the normal wish for enlightenment, bodhicitta, which I've described to you tonight so far, is called deceptive bodhicitta. That's here. Number one, here, and what I taught you before of what bodhicitta means are exactly the same thing. They are the same thing. Ultimate bodhicitta is like a nickname or a password, a secret name given to the direct perception of emptiness. So it doesn't necessarily have anything to do with love, compassion, wishing that other beings could get out of samsara, trying to help all other living beings. It has nothing to do with it. It's called bodhicitta. It has nothing to do with that. Ultimate bodhicitta, Dendam Semke, is the direct perception of emptiness. And by the way, while you're in that perception, that diamond perception, okay, while you're in that state, could you see a sentient being? No, they are not emptiness. The only thing you can see at that moment is emptiness. Are you even aware of yourself? By the way, that's the closest you get to subject and object disappearing, but it's overused. People overrate it. That's not a big deal. It's not what it means. It doesn't mean that you somehow dissolve into the object. That's ridiculous by all standards of all the study of Buddhist mental functions and the nature of the mind and everything you've ever studied about that. It's not obviously untrue. That's not what happens. There's a sort of nature between the object and the subject which we'll explore. What I mean, there's this emphasis given by certain people on the term or the idea that the subject and object dissolve, or they become the same, or one becomes the other, there is no subject or object. That's just not true. You can't perceive anything without that division. That's not at all the meaning of that phrase. And people misconstrue it constantly.
It doesn't come out.
No, it doesn't say that. It says maybe something, there's no confusion. But that's not what it means. It's just keep it in mind, store it, we'll talk about it when we get to that someday. It's not what it means. So, ultimate bodhicitta is the direct perception of emptiness.
Nothing to do with bodhicitta.
No, nothing to do with bodhicitta in the way you've always learned it. So, which one is the Buddha asking you to have? When he says, by the way, when a person achieves nirvana, nobody achieves nirvana.
Because there is no person.
I can see a person, therefore there exists a person. Semi dupa. Semi mipa yubitseni. Definition of existence is anything I perceive with semi. Anything I perceive with a correct perception.
With accurate perception?
Valid perception, I mean.
Okay.
It's a good point. It's valid but inaccurate. Is that right?
But if you're in that meditation, you're in that ultimate bodhicitta, the valid perception no longer holds true.
Yeah, you cannot see a sentient being. It's impossible.
So
you can only see
true. There are no sentient beings.
Now, what they explain is that Semkeki Sindigone, in fact, the definition of the perfection of wisdom of Prajnaparamita is Semkeki Sindigone Toni Popolo, which means to perceive emptiness but be under the constant influence of bodhicitta. So bodhicitta cannot arise in your mind. You can't feel love. You can't see sentient beings. You can't wish they were not suffering. But it's like all through your mind, all through your heart, while you're perceiving it. It's not manifest. It's not conscious. Okay. If it were, you'd be perceiving the lower reality.
So he's asking to be that bodhisattva is the
He wants you to get the Dhinna Samkhya, but you must have Kutta Samkhya. But a sentient being can't have both at the same time. Impossible. You can be under the influence of the first and be having the second. But you can't have them both in your mind at the same time. It's impossible. It's impossible for us to see the emptiness of the sentient being directly and to see the sentient being at the same time.
So
Sutta saying, by the way, when you achieve Dunam Semke, there will be no other sentient beings that you'll be aware of.
That's not exactly what it means, but it's a very good shot. Okay, what does it mean?
Well, you won't be able to be aware of any sentient beings when you are...
It sounds good, but that's not what he means. I mean, it's related to that, but that's not what it is. Okay. And for this, we need to know, what is emptiness empty of? Inherent existence. Inherent existence, okay? If I say, is there a purple elephant in this room, what do you say?
No.
I mean, an elephant with a fluorescent, naturally fluorescent purple skin that wandered into this room while we were taking our break. It doesn't exist in this, I mean, forget behind the curtain, we can't see.
Can you see it?
Huh? Does it exist in this room? No, okay, there is an emptiness. Yeah, you're not having seven bucks. There is an emptiness of a naturally fluorescent, full-grown elephant in this room right now. There is that emptiness here. That is one of the emptinesses in this room. It's not the meaning of ultimate emptiness at all, obviously. It's not going to liberate you to realize there's no purple elephant in this room, okay? But there is an emptiness of a purple elephant in this room. That does exist in this room. The emptiness or the lack of a purple elephant does exist in this room. So whenever you say emptiness in Buddhism, you have to say empty of what? Or what's not there? Okay. And that's what we call a self-existent thing. Okay. A self-existent person. Does it exist? Does a self-existent person exist?
No.
Can you imagine a self-existent person? Yeah. Why? Because you can imagine a naturally fluorescent full-grown purple elephant, okay? I mean, when I say that, you get what we call a dachi.
Hey, wait a minute. Naturally, whatever he is, it's not necessarily possible.
No, by definition, it isn't possible. And we're going to explain
you
why.
You didn't say he was a self-existent elephant.
No, I said naturally purple fluorescent full-grown elephant. I don't think it exists. I mean, I haven't seen all the planets in the universe. Let's say in New York this afternoon, you know. I mean, if you want. I'm trying to think of something that doesn't exist. Okay? What I mean is, it's just a natural impossibility. When people say the self, they should always put quotation marks. Why?
Because it's
just
possible.
There's no such thing. You could say a self, or a supposed self, or a so-called self, or a so-called person. It doesn't exist. Okay? It just doesn't exist. But you better know what it would be like if it did exist, or what? You can't...
know that it doesn't exist.
You can't establish its emptiness. You know? If you didn't know what an elephant is, and you don't know what purple is, and I say this room is empty of purple elephants, you can't evaluate that. You don't know if that's true or not. You have to be able to imagine what a self-existent thing is like. You imagine it constantly. Every thought of yours is infected by believing in that.
Well, you believe in it, but it doesn't mean that you...
No, it's quite a different thing to what we call identified, Carly. You know that word.
Object of being negated.
Yeah, what?
Gotcha.
Gotcha. Yeah,
gotcha.
This is Carly's favorite song.
Say it.
Okay, gotcha. Say gotcha.
Gotcha.
Gotcha. Gotcha means the thing we deny. The thing we say, hey, that don't exist. In the case of the first example, what is it?
Pink person.
A purple elephant. A naturally purple colored elephant. That was the gotcha. If you don't know what Buddhism is trying to say doesn't exist, how could you ever perceive that non-existence of it? How could you ever know that it wasn't here if you didn't know what you were trying to deny? If you don't know what I say, if you don't know what I mean when I say self-existent, well then how could you ever perceive emptiness? And each school has its own definition of what self-existence is. Each of the great four schools of ancient India has its own idea, and in fact, that largely defines the different schools. Their idea of what self-existence means, the idea of what Atman means, is largely what divides the four schools. Because they each have a different idea of it.
But you don't define it by what it is. You discover it by finding what it isn't.
The, The way in which the four schools define what a self-existent thing would be like is what distinguishes largely the four schools. Their imagination of what a self-existent thing would be like if it existed. And it's important to realize that. It doesn't exist. You're trying to imagine something that doesn't even exist. Now, what is that? Gacha is anything. Now you have to. This is higher school. Majjhimika Prasangika. This is the higher school of all Buddhism says the thing that we say does not exist is anything which could exist without your projection, without your label. And I'll explain what that means. Okay, I'll explain that. Gacha means anything which could exist without your projection or your label. And now I'll tell you what that means. Okay. Now we'll go into that. We got 3 minutes to explain all of my things. I'll just do it, you know. There's three basic choices here. Okay, Mike the monk, all right? I'm trying to identify the monk. Okay? Trying to identify the monk. What is it about me, visually, that you could say as a monk? Okay? And this is the way this whole example, which is ancient, is very, very widely mistaught, misunderstood, miswritten about. Everyone gets confused. No one ever perceives emptiness. Okay? And it really has to be presented correctly. Okay, I'll take a shot. this is your... First we talk about my parts, all right? Lower part of my robe and the upper part of my robe. Okay? Is there anything inherently in the robes that suggests monk? Is there anything in the lower part of the robe? If I hung this lower part of the robe up over there on a hanger and you walked into the room over there, would you say, oh, there's the monk?
Yeah.
You say there's the monk. The bottom part of the robe.
Yeah.
Would you say that's the monk?
No, I wouldn't say this is monk's robe because it's patched.
No, you would say it's a
and
monk's
robe.
But would you say that is the monk?
No.
No. Okay. It is a part. You know, if someone cut off my hand and put it over there on the carpet, you know, just walk in and say, hey, Mike, how are you? No. I mean, there's nothing about the parts, okay, themselves, which is the monk. Independent, you know, individually. Individually, there's nothing about the parts. There's nothing about the lower robe by itself. There's nothing about the upper robe by itself, which is the monk. Which is the sign of the monk. Which is the monk? The second part of the analysis, you gotta know the three, okay? It's your last question in your homework. So I am not my parts, okay? There's nothing about my hand, there's nothing about my arm, there's nothing about my lower robes that you could say is mine.
It is you.
Okay, now what about, there's another outrageous choice, which would it be something else? You know, if I put a policeman's uniform on a hanger and you came, we call it other, something other than a monk's robe. Okay? If you went into my room over there and you saw a policeman's uniform standing up there, which is what we call something other than my parts or my whole, okay? Would you call that the monk? No, obviously a stupid choice. Okay? So we've eliminated two choices. I am not my parts individually. And I am not something other than my parts. I remember asking this question to Carmen's 3-year-old daughter when she was this tall. Now she's this tall. And I said, am I my... You know, I wanted to be mystical. So I said, am I my arm? And she said, no. I said, am I him? She said, no. I said, am I the whole thing? She said, well, of course. And then I was like, blew away my... I wanted to be smart, you know. And I said, oh, she's right, you know. And so, but the books say, the third choice, okay, am I the whole thing? Am I the whole collection of parts all put together?
Not really, because if you take one away, you're still there.
Yeah. No, it's much, much different, and it's very, very misunderstood. Because I am my whole. I am the whole, all put together. Of course I am. You know that. I am.
Your hand got chopped off and was on top of the garbage can, you wouldn't be Mike the Monk anymore.
No, of course. I'd be... Oh, you'd say Mike the Monk got his hand cut off. And when I went to work the next day, they say, oh, Mike's got his hand cut off. I'm still Mike.
Less of a monk.
So what I'm saying is, it's all the parts, okay? It is obviously all the parts that is called Mike. Okay? So why do the books always say he's not his parts, he's not something other than the parts, and he's not the whole thing together?
Because you're not merely.
It's a different thing. Okay, it's this.
It's conventional, no?
It's this. We don't have much time. If an Eskimo came in here, all right, never saw a Buddhist monk, never heard of a Buddhist monk, would these same parts be monk to him?
No.
Not at all. Okay. What does that prove about my parts being monk to monk? It depends on?
The perceiver.
On you. Okay. It depends on some projection or some label from your side. For me to be a monk and listen, for you.
Does that mean the parts we did in the last words was no good?
That's just refining.
For you to be a monk, and I can't hear with this thing.
I'm sorry. By the way, Pat volunteered to fix it. This is very important, very, very important. They screw up this every time they explain it, okay? If there was anything inherently existing about me, if I were inherently a monk, then an Eskimo could come in here and he'd see this red costume and he'd say, oh, Buddhist monk, Tibetan, look the stick. You know, really, seriously, that's the whole point. Okay? Without your projection onto me, without your label applied to me by your mind, I'm not a monk for you. It's important to say for you.
Yeah.
It's very important to say for you. For me, I am because I know what that is. Why do I know what that is? That's a big subject. That's a very big subject.
And this is the dynamic of persona.
Absolutely. Highest meaning of dependent origination is.
So according to lower school, then what we did before is accurate, the analysis of the parts.
It's even according to Prasangika, it's accurate and insufficient. Okay? That's all. But that's the ultimate meaning. That's the ultimate meaning.
So number three in 5 or 10 words or less was?
I am not the collection of my whole. I'm not the whole of my parts. I'm not the collection. Who you call?
You said that.
I'm not my parts individually, number one.
I'm not my parts individually. I'm not something else, obviously. Mm-hmm. And I'm not even the whole of all my parts put together. How's that? I am not all my parts put together. And you must say independently, which means independent of your projection onto me.
And that only goes for number three. Independent of your projection.
It actually goes for the first three. If there's no observer, then it's there.
It actually must apply to the first two as well.
Okay.
But it's easier to present it the way I did it. We'll get more subtle later. Okay. Now the last thing is.
Michael,
you're essentially saying if there's no perceiver, which is not only what you really are saying, if there's nobody to perceive.
That's not the point. It's not the log in the woods thing. Okay, that's not the point. The point is, unless you label me something, I am not that for you. Okay, and that's the meaning of my independent origin, my dependent origination. That's the ultimate meaning of dependent origination. There are less comprehensive meanings of dependent origination, which we will study, which we have studied, but I'm giving you the highest one right off. Okay? So now I ask you a question. There's a Buddhist exercise called Tani Tapa Dakten Zawe Tsenami Nyebe Echa, which means when you look for the real mic, you don't find it. When you look for the mic that was given the label, you can't find it. You will never find it. What does it mean? It means, check me out in those three ways. Try to find me in those three ways. What are they? We'll repeat them. Am I my lower robe? Is the monk the lower robe by itself?
No.
No. If you look for Mike, the monk, in the lower robe by itself, what do you find?
A monk?
Nothing. No, we're just restricting our search to Mike the monk. Not the lower robe. Okay. If you're looking for Mike the monk, and you only look at the lower robe by itself, what do you come up with?
could be it might come up nearby, but
you come up with nothing, okay?
So
you come up with nothing. That is emptiness. That's one kind of emptiness. Now, if you look for Mike the Monk in a policeman's uniform, what do you come up with?
Nothing.
If you look for Mike the Monk in all of my parts put together, what do you find?
Nothing.
Bad answer. That was a trick question.
You find your perception.
Oh, of course you find me.
But not separate from the other person.
Now I'll give you another question. If you look for Mike the Monk, and all the parts of Mike the Monk put together, which does not depend on your thinking of me as Monk, can you find it?
No.
Then it's no. But you must add that part. You must add that second part. And people don't. And people go to lectures on emptiness, and they come away saying, boy, it sounded profound, but I don't know what the hell I'm talking about. These little three-year-old kids said, of course you're all your parts of emptiness. You are. As long as someone projects onto that Monk. Where do those projections come from?
Past karma.
Yeah, past karma and mental states. If you didn't have past karma for certain kinds of lousy objects, what would happen?
An experience.
They wouldn't exist for you. There's a key there. Something interesting there. Okay. Anyway, so that's how you establish emptiness. That's how you find emptiness. You look for an elephant's leg, that's an elephant. No, empty. You look for a dog's leg, or a dog that's an elephant, you don't find it. You look for an elephant that's all the parts of the elephant put together to a person who doesn't know what an elephant is and can't conceive elephants. And it's not there either. And that's all. And you find emptiness. And that is emptiness. And that's ultimate emptiness. That's the emptiness of the dogma. That's the emptiness of an elephant that doesn't depend on your perceptions. It's the emptiness of Mike. It doesn't depend on your projections and your labeling me. Now that you're sufficiently confused.
And you're calling those three different kinds of emptiness.
Well, they're all ways to establish one emptiness. Okay. And by the way, so that's what the Buddha said. He's saying when you look at those sentient beings, when you're on the subway, and there are all those mother beings that you're going to say, you have to keep that in mind. And it's very, very important because ultimately, this holds work. Very, very important. Very, very important. Because ultimately, whether or not you'll ever be able to take them to enlightenment depends totally on your labor. If they didn't exist through your labels, what?
They would be just empty.
Huh?
They would not exist.
And then you couldn't take them to enlightenment. And that's exactly what the Buddha means in that last sentence. That's exactly what it means. If they existed independent of your labels, no one would get to enlightenment. They could not get to enlightenment. And there's a very secret little phrase in there. Read the first question, or it's on the first page of the reading. Because after he says, you got to save all sentient beings. You have to save the sentient beings who have minds or don't have minds. You have to save the sentient beings who have bodies or don't have bodies. You have to save the sentient beings that are born in all four ways. You have to save anyone who's ever called a sentient being. And that the whole key is right there. The whole key to the Diamond Sutra is right there. In that little word, anyone called a sentient being, anyone labeled a sentient being. Yeah, it is. It really is. It's exactly the same phrase used in all my communication.
Then the question I have is, it doesn't exist for you if you don't label it and perceive it as such. It still does exist.
Well, long story. Okay. Oh, yeah. Okay. Let's do it. Ready, Kyle? Let's do this one. Don't hang up. Sorry to keep you late. I'm really sorry.